And I think what bothers also some of them, especially to admit, hey, because this really hurts them, of all things, is to admit that the independentistas were right.
Welcome to episode 32 of the David Binkowski Podcast. Today, my guest is Javier Hernandez. Javier was born in Rio Piedras, Puerto Rico. He's a father. Happy Father's Day. He's an artist, linguist, entrepreneur, world traveler, indigenous rights activist, and he's pro-sovereignty for Puerto Rico. He's got a BA in political science and international relations from Florida International University. He's got his master's in internal communication from American University, and he's got his MS in education from Lehman College in New York. He's earned certificates in diplomacy of small states, emergency management, homeland security planning, global security issues, and nonviolent conflict and civil resistance. He's committed to social justice, cultural activism, indigenous rights, and Puerto Rican decolonization, self-determination, and national sovereignty. He speaks 10 languages. He reads 13 languages, and he's written several books, including, which is how I first noticed him, was PR Exit or Prexit, Forging Puerto Rico's Path to Sovereignty. He also wrote a book called Puerto Rico, The Economic Case for Sovereignty. These books are both in English. They're also available in Spanish. There are other books as well, but his latest book is titled Puerto Rico for Puerto Ricans, Why We'll Always Be That Way. So I want to have him on the podcast to talk about this book, because I think it's something that if you are an Americano, you should hear this information. So here it is directly from the horse's mouth. Javier, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And thank you to all your listeners.
It's our pleasure and my pleasure to have you on again as someone who's read some of your books, not all of them, but some of your books. I've read your latest books. That's what I want to talk about. I live here. I'm from the U.S. and I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of listening and try to educate myself on kind of what the issues are here, and then obviously knowing what the issues are in the U.S. And so your books speak to me because there's a lot that's going on politically. There's a lot that's going on in the world that to me are going to get worse. These problems are not going to get better. They're going to get worse. Not to be a pessimist, just being a realist. And so this is why your books really speak to me. And I think people should hear what you have to say about them. And I want to jump right into your book, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
So the first part of the book talks about Puerto Ricans being a nation and having their own distinct national identity. Now, from my perspective, again, having lived in Michigan, New Jersey, New York, and it's very true. And now here for the last 4 years, almost, it's very, very true that Puerto Rico is very, very different than the U.S. But I'd like you to talk through the roots of colonialism in Puerto Rico and kind of the recognition of nationalities and kind of what you outline in the book around just the Puerto Rican distinct nationality that is here.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yes. Well, part of being a colony is, and this would happen with the U.S. or with Spain or with France or whoever is ruling Puerto Rico, this would happen the same way. Part of colonialism is that it tries to deny your distinctiveness, that you're a nation. And it tries to basically say that, you know, you don't deserve freedom because you're not a nation. So that's the argument. That's the belief. But Puerto Rico is a nation. I mean, there are people who would, you know, say that we're not a nation, but they see that just for political purposes. They even know that Puerto Rico is a nation,
right?
Even those who say that it's not,
right?
But they say it because it's the narrative that the U.S., especially some politicians, they like to hear that. They like to hear certain phrases, fellow Americans, and those catchy phrases that you know, pulls on the heartstrings of some Americans. But we're a nation, no matter what people say, or you know, the reality is that Puerto Ricans are Latin Americans. We're Hispano-Caribeños. We're in the Caribbean. We have over 400 years. I mean, that's older than the U.S. itself of existence. Before the U.S. even came here to Puerto Rico. So we have our own nationality, ways of thinking, language, culture, literature. I mean, and then Puerto Ricans have been involved in many world events, you know, and involved in wars in Spain, in Europe, you know, even fighting against Napoleon. You know, Puerto Ricans were in Latin America fighting against Spain, you know, in Venezuela, Colombia, and Mexico, and even in Peru. Puerto Ricans were even around in the wars that, you know, the wars that were in Louisiana, fighting for U.S. independence. So Puerto Ricans we're everywhere, but we are recognized, even, you know, as a separate nation, as a separate people, and even under Spanish rule, the Spaniards saw us as different. You know, now again, for political purposes, they would refer to us as like those like insular Spaniards or the criollos, you know, other terms. But it was very difficult for the Spanish colonial elite, the officials, to come out and say, oh, those are Puerto Ricans, because that would make us different, you know. But again, as I say in the book, Puerto Ricans are a nation, and that's it. Every definition of nationality.
And there's a long history there. And we'll talk about this, I guess, in the next couple chapters, but there's a history that's there of a denial of people trying to bury the nationalism and bury things like flying the flag, even something as simple as flying the Puerto Rican flag. There's a history that's there of generations of people who have, you know, joined on with this narrative that no, we're not a nation. But in reality, again, the reality of it is, I don't know of any other. I'm really struggling to think of other cultures that, especially as an Americano, and seeing, you know, where the Puerto Rican flag is everywhere, whether they're traveling, hiking, and reaching the top of Mount Everest, like whatever it is, that is the Puerto Rican flag. So not the U.S. flag, not the state that they may, whatever. It's Puerto Rico. It's the Puerto Rican flag. And the fact that the Puerto Rican parade just happened in New York City, recognizing that, yes. it's interesting. The fact that there's this whole movement, and not even getting into the whole like bombing and murdering independentistas, torturing them at Ramey, and getting into all that, there's always been this history of nationalism and of it being a country. I mean, for God's sakes, Puerto Rico competes on the global level in the Olympics. Like, that if you weren't a nation, you would not be doing that, right? So you would just be part of the U.S. team or what have you. So I think that one of the things people don't understand, especially if they've been here as a tourist, let's say, and they've gone to just San Juan, and they go to a resort, and they say, oh, I love it there. It's great. Everyone speaks English. And then I'm like,
in the hotel.
Yeah, in the hotel. And I'm like, come on out west. come and see some of the areas that aren't maybe tourist areas. Go inland a little bit, and it's not that way. So this, the part of your book talks about that Spanish is the national language here. And, you know, it is Spanish first. Although, again, in all fairness, Boricua who look at me when I walk in somewhere, 6'6", Polish looking gringo, they're like, English. Like, I don't even get a chance to speak Spanish half the time. And I try, I really do try, but it's Spanish is the language here. And that's the part to me where, as I think about culture, you know, people practice English to go to the U.S. or they go to the U.S. and then try really hard to learn English so they can assimilate. And I don't necessarily see that being the case here.
No. And there's a long history of U.S. policies that try to eradicate Spanish, try to eradicate national identity. You know, our flag was banned. Our national emblem was banned. I mean, literally, and it was only English in schools for the first, you know, decades of U.S. rule. And that was the norm. And if you complained about it, sorry, you something would happen to you, or you'd disappear, or something bad. But yeah. Puerto Ricans resisted, and we won. We defeated all those English-only laws. They tried to ban the Puerto Rican national emblem. Yep. And they put some other one, which I don't know if you've seen the pictures of it. It looks, it was designed by Tiffany's. Yeah, and it, like, you know, like you open the little blue box, there's a review envelope.
Yeah,
like, what the hell? And it was actually called the El Escudo Intruso, like the intruder seal. And it never took on. No one really liked it. It was ugly. And then then they had to bring back the original one. The Congress even tried to change our name to Puerto Rico, to Puerto Rico, to make it sound more English. And for the first 30 years, it was like that. An official document, Puerto Rico, you know, not Puerto Rico. And so they failed at that. You know, it's just the policies of assimilation have failed in Puerto Rico in terms of turning Puerto Ricans into, I like to call them like Spanish surnamed Americans, you know, that identify with, you know, like, oh, you know, with the U.S. and American culture. And no, we don't. That's the point. Almost over 100 years of U.S. rule, and we're still Boricuas, and we're still very proud of being our national identity. We've resisted all these policies that were meant to eradicate us, and we're still here. We won. And, you know, and just even recognizing that Spanish is the vernacular for some people, again, for political purposes, is crazy. You know, they just want to keep thinking that, well, Spanish is, you know, it's like that little side, is the language of the help, you know, that type of mentality. And then, you know, that the U.S. flag just automatically brings English speakers, you know, and that's not true, you know. And yeah, so in Puerto Rico, if you come here, you know, again, if you immigrate and you live your life here, you're going to realize from day one, it's Spanish. Unless, and now there are people, and I've met some of these people that usually Americans that come and they just surround themselves with other Americans, or they're military people that only live on the military base. Right. They don't know any other Boricuas, and that's it. Well, in those situations, yeah, then you can maintain the English speaking, you know, society. But if you integrate yourself in Puerto Rican society, like other immigrants have in the past, like there'd be Germans in Puerto Rico, I mean, Irish come to Puerto Rico, all these Catalans, Corsicans, all these people. And after what, even French, even after one generation, they become Boricuas, you know? And then even Americans, I remember one of the leaders of the Latinx revolt against Spain was Matias Brugman. Mm-hmm. His family was from Louisiana,
yep.
You see? So, and then one generation later, and he's already leading the revolution against Spain. So those are amazing things that people need to know and embrace.
Even in my circles, if you will, or even in my life, the house that we bought was built by a Frenchman. Mm. And the house, and he still lives here. He's in San Juan now.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So this house was built, you know, I think in the 70s, and then it's this Franken house, but it's all his parts added on. But the house was originally built in the 70s, and it was by a Frenchman. And he still lives on the island. He did not leave. And, you know, it's not rare. I think people, it's less rare than people think to find people who've lived here, that mm-hmm. moved here and have been here for a full generation, decades, et cetera. But I have noticed that there is an issue within the language barrier, which is the class system, right? So that's where, and the political elite kind of fall into that as well,
yeah.
Where the opportunities will go to like, oh, do you speak English? And then you get the opportunity. Whereas if you only speak Spanish, you may be cut out from the opportunity, which is short-sighted given the fact that our proximity to the rest of the Caribbean, to Latin America, to Central South America, like this should be a natural thing that Spanish is here because we have access to so many people who do speak Spanish and could do business with them and learn from them and mm-hmm. educate and do all those things. So I just noticed that, like you said, I've met some gringos here who don't speak a word of Spanish. Like they speak none and all their friends are other gringos. I'm like, then why did you move here? Like it makes absolutely no sense. I wanted to get away from where I lived, go to be in a place that's exactly like where I left, or try to make it exactly like where I left. It doesn't make any sense to us. Mm-hmm. To me and my family, it makes absolutely no sense. But I did want to talk to you about, speaking of the class system, and I think this is a nice segue into the push for statehood and this faux appearance that they put up And nothing's funnier to me. And again, I'm not making fun of somebody because of what they want. You can want what you want. That's your choice. But it is a little funny. You know, there was the national anthem being played recently at some statehood or event, and like nobody knew the words. There's mouthing. It's like, you know,
it's embarrassing.
It's like when I first heard Bad Bunny, I'm like, are these words? Like some of the songs. I was training a bunch of high school boys, and one of the songs came out of the gym, and I was like, those aren't words. And they're like, no, they're words. And you start to listen and you start to actually learn what the words are and all that. But it's strange, because since we've lived here, even Puerto Rico's missed out on opportunities for education and for other grants and stuff, because the quote unquote statehood people that we want to be a state so bad, but we didn't know English, so we couldn't apply for the grant or the education money or whatever it is. We've lost out on millions and millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. For people who claim to want to be a state, but don't want to take the time to actually learn the language of doing business in the states. It's crazy to me.
Yeah. The statehooders, you know, they're very, now again, you're going to have a class, like the upper class, political class, yep. The people that are always, you know, always in connected with the ruling elite type people. Even those people, all of them may not speak English, just a few of them. And then, you know, basically they don't need to know English sometimes. If you're going to be the senator of Guayama or whatever, you don't need to speak English. But in order to, if you're going to have any in contact with Americans, then they want you to have English skills. But that's another thing where, you know, they want to be a state, but they don't push English. Or they don't even know English themselves. That's the problem. They don't even know. And again, I've seen some stakeholder events where they put, you know, they think that all you have to do to impress Americans is to get an American flag, wave it around, and that's enough. That's it. That you're 100% American now. But when they put the national anthem, they don't know it.
Right.
Right. I'll even send you a link. I'm sorry, I don't have it here, but you could go on YouTube, or actually, if you go actually in the Prexitbook.com, that page in the bottom, I put a few videos on there. There's a video of someone asking statehood leaders, hey, can you sing the national anthem? And they don't know. These are the leaders, not some person in the campo. The leaders, and they do not know, and they're laughing about it. It's not even like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't really know it. No, they're like, ha ha ha, I have no idea. Ha ha ha. They're laughing that they don't know the anthem of the US.
Well, there's a whole, like, I mean, like, there's an entire, the thing that I think they don't get, and obviously you and I do, but that they don't understand is that the U.S. sees through that bullshit, right? Like yep. Ricardo Rossello is in Virginia/DC right now as we speak, and Nancy Pelosi barred him from coming to the Senate floor, even though he was quote unquote elected by Puerto Ricans to go and push for statehood. So like just the tone deafness, the cluelessness of like how the U.S. views this shit, because they see through it. I mean, they see through it as clear as day. And the only time that there's any kind of like, you know, let's do something for Puerto Rico is to score political points at home, because they maybe have Boricua living in their district or their region or whatever.
Yep, that's it.
And one of the things that it's in the book, but the one of the things that just is dumbfounding to me, and I brought this up right off the bat, because obviously seeing the pride and seeing the, you know, the culture here, I said, wouldn't people be pissed if the Puerto Rican national team went away? Like, isn't that
great?
Right? And they're like, and the statehooders were saying, we don't care about that. I'm like, oh, that's your official position? So I don't ever want to see any statehooder ever congratulate the national team then. You didn't back them from the beginning. Don't back us at the end. Right. I mean,
yeah,
it's this weird, just a very weird self-loathing of
colonialism.
Like, yeah.
You hate yourself.
Yeah.
Because you see yourself as inferior. Thus you hate yourself. And the only way you think you can ever aspire to be great is to not be you, is to be something else.
Right.
To be an American or whatever you think that is. You know, so statehood or speaking English or, you know, all these little things, you know, having an American flag, that makes you a better human. They believe this.
Well, that is marketing. That is, by the way, that is brand affinity 101. You plus my brand is a better you. That's a whole bullshit thing in marketing that they sell. And it's like, and then again, having lived here, having seen some of the great things that have happened here and Boricua have done great things abroad, I'm just like dumbfounded by it. I'm like, if we could harness all that talent, instead of exporting the 600 Colegio kids that just graduated with engineering degrees, instead of exporting 400 of them or more, what if they had a chance to stay here and actually help build the island and have competent people in positions to do things like roads instead of rewarding an asphalt company where everyone's going to jail now because they all took bribes, yep. Like shit like that, where you're just like, am I the only one who sees this? Because this is like,
no, believe me, you're not. Others see it. You're not the only one. Others see it. And literally it's, you know, because the statehood party in Puerto Rico and even the Populares also, they thrive on dependency, on poverty, because when they have the poverty, the answer to all their problems, oh, we just need more federal funds. We need Americanos, you know. And then anything where Puerto Rico does by itself, for example, like the Casa Pueblo, yep, you know, situation. We're
going to bring that one up.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, like anything that Puerto Ricans do on their own with their own resources, with their own leadership, with their own guidance, and it's successful, it's great for us. But the government hates it and the stakeholders hate it because it's an example. It's showing proof that Puerto Ricans can aspire and do great things on our own without asking Mr. Johnson or without asking permission or without begging for federal dollars. No, we don't need that. We can do it on our own. And when we're successful, they hate that and they try to put obstacles or ignore it or whatever. But whenever literally, you can even look up their recent press conferences or visits to D.C. They're only, and this is my big criticism that I talk about in the books a lot, their only economic plan is asking for more money, begging for more federal dollars. That's it. They don't have any other economic development plan or ideas. I mean, I have a whole book full of ideas for them. Please use them. Take them. I don't have copyright over that. Use them, please. But they won't, because having a successful Puerto Rico, a successful and rich Puerto Rico, is what they don't want. They want dependency, poverty, you know, the Boricua all poor and all that, because then that helps their party. And in this book, the new book, I even found a study that was done. Like there was a correlation between the higher the poverty, the more support for the statehood party.
Yep.
So they want poverty. They thrive on it. You know, and that's something that it's, some people have noticed it and they know about this, but some people, they still don't understand that aspect.
Yeah, well, we talked about this before we started recording, but it's very much ingrained by generation after generation. You vote for the color, right? You vote for red, you vote for blue, you vote for green. Like, it's just, you vote color, not policy, not outcomes, not plans, not ideas. The idea is we're going to be a state. And I'm, like I said, coming from the U.S., it's laughable to me. I'm not shitting on like somebody who wants that or they think life would be better because they've been sold that. But like, I've been to Disney. Like, come on now. Like, I know what's bullshit and what's real. And, you know, and obviously the political climate in the U.S., it's just not going to happen. So like, just asking for federal dollars, which again, what Republicans do when in 2022, 2024, those are going to dry up. That money's going away. The U.S. is in shrink mode. And we're going to be left holding the bag, just like when Trump, after Maria, refused for years to release any funds to rebuild things. So yeah, there's just a very clear writing on the wall that's there. And to have them say, well, that's the only path, we can't do it on our own. And I'm like, but I've seen it done on our own. What are you talking about? Like,
yeah,
I loved in not in this book, but when you talk about having a national rail system, we're out here driving around at $5 a gallon gas. And I'm driving around looking at the cars. I'm like, we're all suckers, man. We are all suckers between insurance and repairs and loans and gas and you name it. We are all suckers because we could be paying a fraction of that and have mass transit. And we're just not doing it. Right. So, and it doesn't make sense. Like financially, it makes no sense. Logically, it makes no sense. And then I saw your map and I thought I saw there was a young person that retweeted it and said, I will die someday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I need to, I need to ride on the independence train or whatever. And it was like, yeah, I mean, like that's, but that's a policy decision that's based on what's right to do for the island. Right. And when you start to, when you start to look at the financials of it, again, $5 a gallon gas, we're seeing with our energy prices, they're going up again because the cost, we, for some godforsaken reason, thought that in 2022, it'd be a good idea to rely on fossil fuels still and rebuild this grid. And it's like, I would rather suffer for 2 years with a bad power grid if we were doing microgrids with solar everywhere and just deal with it for 2 years. At least I know there's an end game and there's a deadline.
Exactly.
Yeah. As opposed to like, well, in 20 years, we'll start to transition to solar and maybe we'll be there someday. It's like, how? What's your plan? Because right now you're just, you're literally just like, we're taking the federal funds. We're only helping to supply the LNG exports in the U.S. and the natural gas companies that were failing because gas plummeted, right? Natural gas prices plummeted. But here comes Puerto Rico to help prop them up because we're going to use that as our bridge, as Jay Goh said, our resident commissioner. And it just, there's so many decisions that are made that are so, they're made based on financial decisions that help benefit the U.S. and their corporations, not what helps the island. But it's sold as if that's the, it's sold like that's the solution. It's like, we don't need all these cars, man. Like we just don't. And it's, you mentioned the part about poverty and statehood. And I've had discussions with middle-class Boricua who are here, who are working, who are, you know, making a living and they've got a house and all that. And they may be for statehood. And then I start asking them about the realities of it and saying like, okay, so you're cool paying federal taxes then? Like, well, how much would that be? I'm like, well, let's do the math based on your income. And they're like, holy shit, I'm not voting for statehood. Like, you can make a financial, like, just simple arguments like that work with people because they're fact-based. It's not based on some, maybe someday waving a flag, well, whatever, bullshit. It's, you know, it's the reality. So,
you know, anyway, quickly with about the taxes, the 2014 Government Accountability Office, the GAO, that report, I mean, I've read that over and over. I mean, that's that was a damning report when that came out. And it's still amazing. But basically, one of the best juicy parts of it is that the report, not me or the Independence Party, the report says that the federal tax burden on a hypothetical state of Puerto Rico would be over $5 billion. All right. That's enough, according to the report, that it'll destroy the Puerto Rican economy, okay? Because in order to maintain that high level of federal taxes, Puerto Rico will have to lower its state taxes, and then that would then in turn affect services, education, and all these other things. And it would literally, the report itself says, the federal tax burden would destroy the Puerto Rican economy.
Right.
Case closed. I mean, it would destroy, it's not just like, oh, a little more expensive. It would destroy the economy.
Yep.
And the stakeholders, they just pretend that doesn't exist. It's like, like, okay, blah, blah. Let's continue, wave the flag and talk about, you know, federal dollars. And like, but what about the report? You know, they ignore it. They also ignore the, you know, because they say about the Olympics that Puerto Rico would have an Olympic team under statehood. No.
No,
there's a federal law, the Amateur Sports Act of 1978, that says that there's only one Team USA, and that's it. There's no old state New Jersey Olympic team and whatever. But they just ignore that. It's like, there are rules, the feds are telling you, you can't do it, and you're just like, ha, 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 I'm not going to listen to that.
It reminds me of the real world version of that. Here is when you drive by like a roadside pizza place, like a pizza truck, and their logo is Krusty the Clown from The Simpsons, and you're like, you can't use that. But like the reality is, no one's paying attention, right? So like the U.S. is not paying attention to it. So like, ah, whatever, no one cares. So
no one cares, or Mickey Mouse, or these cartoons that you're like, really? And no one is going to, I mean, but you know what? But I get it. No one is going to go after Jose, the pizza truck guy.
Right. And there's a bigger issue just talking about the statehood thing is the fact that like from a representation in Congress standpoint, and this is another, again, like an obvious, like the GAO report, you're like, hey, this says it would destroy us. Why would you do it? Right. The same thing. when you're like, no, we can be. I remember one of their political strategists, which to me is just a con artist at this point, because it's not going to happen. So you're just taking people's money to lie to them. Yeah. But when I said, like, this isn't going to work, like, I'm like, you thought bankrupting the island was going to make us a state? Like,
yeah.
What's the logic?
So the logic is they would bankrupt it, create such a economic chaos that then the federal government would feel so sorry. All these poor Puerto Ricans feel so sorry, tear, and they would bail Puerto Rico out, and that bailout would be statehood.
Right.
That is literally the plan that they had in the 90s and what they were trying to do now.
Well, I brought it up in the political strategy. She's like, we have 36 more tactics we can use. I'm like, dude, just stop.
No.
Just stop. Like, you've lied for 100 years or 60 years. Or you've been lying to people forever that it's going to have, you know, oh, we flew up to D.C. and stood on the Capitol steps with an American flag. We're going to be a state. Like, that's not how it works. That doesn't mean shit. But the congressional thing is interesting because they never talk about the fact that there's only 435 seats in Congress. So where are these seats for Puerto Rico going to come from? Is Texas going to align with statehood so they can lose representation, or California or Wyoming, or like
look, because the Congress has to have that 435. And yet all states have to have minimum, this is, you know, at least one representative in Congress. We have at least minimum one. There are states that have two or three, and they have low populations. Those are the ones that are going to lose a seat or two that I will have to give to Puerto Rico. And those are going to be Dakotas, Nebraska type state, you know, like the Midwest area.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Do you think those people want to lose a congressional power so that... Get to Puerto Rico? No.
I'll even take it a step further, because states like, you know, there's the whole thing with like New York, New Jersey. It's expensive to live there. I believe when I lived in the Catskills, I read that New York was the worst state in the union to retire in. So there's a trend that when, you know, people get to a certain age, they buy a place in Florida, they buy a place down south, and they get the hell out so they could have lower taxes. So do you think New York's going to want to give up seats? I mean, just being like as blue as New York is as a blue state, do you think New York's going to want to surrender seats to an island?
No.
No.
No one does.
No.
But no state wants to give up one seat. They protect that, you know.
Yep.
And so just that one reason is enough to understand that state of the Americans will never, the congressmen are never going to, all right, I'll give up my position, my seat, my district, so that Ponce, Puerto Rico can have the seat.
It's never going to happen. It's beyond magical thinking. And that's what, that to me is where it's so just like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, it's not going to happen. There's so many barriers and so many obstacles that, you know, even with a thriving Puerto Rico economy, even with all these things, there's still massive, massive barriers. And like I've been saying from day one, if you are the person or corporation or wealthy individual or whatever that lives in the U.S. who has a corporation here, or a tax decree, whatever it is, and you have money to influence politics in the U.S., Microsoft, Amazon, right? Pick the company that has a business here that's one of the largest businesses in the U.S. and only growing, by the way. Amazon's not shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon just set up an AWS hub here. Why do you think they did that? It's for tax breaks, right? Mm-hmm. And so they could have an outpost here and say, yep, we're there on the island and we're there full time now. So guess what? We're getting Act 60. Do you think that Amazon's going to say, go ahead and take that away from us? Yeah, just take it away. You know, the logic, and none of it makes sense. And this is where to me, it's like a fantasy world. It's like watching an alternate reality of like, well, that doesn't make sense. And neither does that. And that doesn't make sense either, which is why they've shifted the narrative to, oh, it's about rights. It's about our civil rights. We need to be equal. And I'm like, you don't know how the U.S. works.
I have no idea. Yeah.
I'm not laughing at this need to want to feel equal to be in the U.S., but like your book points out, or your many books point out, like we could be equal if we were our own thing. We don't have to be part of them to beg for equality. Like,
yeah,
basic common human like nature. I don't just seek your approval to have self-worth.
Yeah,
that's not a crazy concept. That's not a crazy concept.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, we could, instead of being equal in a table full of 50 other people fighting for the scraps, you know, dividing up a big pie, we could be our own table. And then we could be at the United Nations in the with international equality. I mean, that's great. Then we need access to funds, investments, all these other things that we could have.
Yeah.
Without having to deal with, you know, fighting with 50 others for the federal pie. Exactly.
If you're listening to this, by the way, if you're listening to the podcast and you're like, well, this sounds too good to be true, and I don't think it's possible because, you know, either your relatives scared you into thinking a certain way, or you live in the U.S. and you're like, there's no way. I know about that island. It's corrupt and it's bankrupt and our dollars pay for that island and all that. Because that's what the bullshit that you hear from people in the U.S. is.
Yep.
I encourage you to pick up Javier's other book, Puerto Rico, The Economic Case for Sovereignty. Look at the numbers. Look at where the money currently goes, where we export money to the U.S., and then where it would come from to help pay for the things that we would lose. It's all mapped out in the book. Like, and if you want to argue that, awesome. We could have a discussion about that. But like, at least read that piece of it. Because if you're thinking about what's the best thing for the island, what would help the island out the most, that book lays out a case for doing that. So again, we've shot down the possibility of statehood because it's not going to happen. And now it's looking at what's an actual solution. Like, what is the actual solution? Because asking for federal funds, having elected officials put in place who then take that money and take bribes in order to hand out those contracts, which is that's the trend here. That's the pattern. That's been the pattern as long as, you know, tale as old as time. That's the pattern here. So that pattern needs to be broken. If it's a broken pattern and you stick with it, you're just asking to be abused. So if you have interest in this, check out Javier's other book. Again, it's called Puerto Rico, The Economic Case for Sovereignty. Now, I want to talk about the elections that are coming up because there's a lot of discussion here on the island because, again, looking at the numbers, not looking at what do I want, not looking at magical thinking, not looking at whatever else, looking at the numbers. The independence movement has gained a lot of traction here. And for the longest time, the statehooders joked about 3%, which is ironic given that's the number that was rounded up to get to the statehood shadow delegates that were sitting in DC doing nothing for the last year. Right. We had a less than 3% turnout across the island for people to pick the representatives to send to the U.S. to go lobby for statehood, in which they were completely unsuccessful and still have been. And in fact, recently there's a status bill in which they came to the island. Three Democrats came to the island and were asking for input. And one person asked, how much input did you meet with the shadow delegates? Did they have any influence in this? And the answer was no. So black and white. They're doing nothing, right? They're wasting taxpayer money by sitting around in DC and chumming it up and palling around while having no impact whatsoever. So that 3% number is thrown in the face of independentistas of saying that's the best you can do. Well, in the last gubernatorial election, that was not the case. Juan Dalmau did fantastically well, historically speaking, for the independence movement. And the more people see, I say this all the time on Twitter, which is, you know, it's a day that ends in Y, there must be a PNP or PPD official being arrested for corruption. Like every day. It's almost daily where someone's either going to jail, being arrested, being charged. Like it's almost daily here. And I have friends in the US that look at my Twitter feed and they're like, is it really fucking that bad? I'm like, yeah, it really does happen every day. And I send them things. They're like, Jesus Christ, like 7 days in a row of seeing this. They're like, okay, I got it. So like, so even those who are moderately aware or care to be even moderately aware are aware that it's a massive issue here. And what is it tied to? What are the roots of all this? Colonialism.
Yep.
It's all tied to it. So I solve problems for a living as you do, do as well. So you look at it, you're like, well, that's not working. Let's try something different, right? And so the 2024 elections are going to be interesting because there's one political party, the PPD, the Popular Democratic Party, that is losing support greatly. You know, independence party that's rising greatly, and a statehood group that's struggling to survive, especially given the embarrassment of what's happened recently with the political situation with the U.S. Basically, you know, our resident commissioner is a Republican, and she worked with the Democrats to create this bill that would give Puerto Rico a path to decolonization. And as soon as one of her Republican colleagues on the committee saw the bill, he said, no, Just flat out no. Not let's talk about it. Not this is a good idea. Nope. Just no. So that's the status of the Republicans. So again, when they win in 2022 and 2024, the answer is going to be no, even harder. And they're going to pull the federal funds on top of that. Mm-hmm. So, but I want to talk about the elections here because I've noticed irregularities, right? When Ricardo Rossello and Julia Keller, who's currently sitting in prison, when she was the education secretary, the decision was made to close schools. And I understand that from a fiscal standpoint, if you have less people, I'm from Detroit. So I understand when you have a bunch of people leaving the city, you can't maintain all that square mileage under the same budgets with the same, it's not possible fiscally to do that. So I understand they said them saying, let's close some schools, what have you. However, what that meant was they also took away locations for people to vote. And I've anecdotally heard older people here say, I'm not standing out in the sun or standing in line to vote. It's not worth it. And so as a result of that, turnout for this last election in Puerto Rico in 2020 was low, very low.
Yeah.
So it's going to be this an issue on the island of getting people to wake up, number one, face reality. Obviously, and I've called for this in your book, you called for this. I think we need election observers.
Yeah.
Because there were irregularities in 2020. There was a recount in San Juan. There were ballots that weren't delivered. There are ballots that went missing. I mean, it was an absolute shit show. And who runs that?
The statehooders.
The statehood party. So it's very convenient that all these awful things are happening with our elections and the people that are trying to essentially rig the election to get what they want are the ones who are in charge of the elections. I personally have called for, I've said either the UN or the US, somebody's got to step in because you can't trust the results.
In the book, I really believe there should be some observers. Of course, the statehood party, they don't want any observers whatsoever because, I mean, they of course, they don't want anyone looking, catching them in the act, of course. And it's different. It's different. If it's Puerto Ricans catching them in the act, the statehood party will just ignore you like they did in 2020. Yeah, whatever. But if it's Johnny Smith from Wyoming catching you, dump ballots into the Bayamo River, that'll get you, see? Then they don't want that.
Yep. What they've done is they've created essentially a consequence-free system on the island, right? Because the judges, the prosecutors, like all this, they're all in cahoots. So they bury the stuff.
There was evidence of the magic ballots. I mean, all these things, videos of the stakeholders touching the ballots and doing stuff, and it went to the courts, and they just dismissed it. And then those judges were affiliated with the statehood party.
Yep.
So, I mean, yeah, it's just a massively corrupt system. They control the system and they don't want any, especially Americans, they don't want Americans going in there and seeing that. And if there were electoral observers from the UN or the Organization of American States, or even, I even suggested the Carter Center. Jimmy Carter has his own democracy center and he sends people all over the world. And I suggested that in the book and some other articles. But as of right now, the stakeholders, the government, Puerto Rico does not want any foreign observers whatsoever, or even domestic, even having Americans come over and just kind of observe. They don't want that either.
Yeah. It's so in the book, it goes into the prospects for an electoral alliance in 2024.
Oh, yeah.
And the need for having election observers. Very quickly, can you talk about this proposed alliance and what that might look like?
Yeah. So again, this is just a proposal, nothing official yet. I think by next year, things will get more cemented. But it would be initially of an alliance mainly of the Independence Party and the Citizens Victory Movement, Victoria Ciudadana Party, and hopefully others. There are other independents and other specific candidates that could join together in a sort of alliance. But the problem is that the statehood party's electoral law, they prohibit alliances. I mean, so it's like really undemocratic. It's like they don't want the opposition to unite. So they have this prohibition of electoral alliances. So any alliance has to somehow finagle some way to, you know, have what's called concerted actions. you know, like that. So that's still being debated how that's going to happen. But in the book, I outline how many votes need to, you know, this alliance,
yep,
those alliances, how much they would need to get, what sectors to focus on, you know, especially the young voters, new voters, and the Soberanistas of the PPD party. Those are going to be the big chunks. If they can hone in on those, I mean, others as well, the diaspora absentee, the other votes, other sections there. But if they focus on the new voters, young voters, and some of the Soberanistas, they would literally have enough voters to win.
Yeah, I've actually talked to some people here who work in politics, who do polling and stuff like that. I'm like, is there a path? You know, like what are the trends you're seeing? And I'm not asking for a biased opinion. I want, just give me the raw data or tell me your interpretation of that data. Mm-hmm. Statehood is not looking great. PPD is really looking bad. And I just can't help but think that the recent events around the status bill, around the embarrassment of your own party colleagues saying no without even like having a discussion, the ineffectiveness of the shadow delegates, all the different things that the PPD has tried to sell as window dressing, that things are moving, things are changing, things are happening. And it's all been bullshit. It's all been 100% bullshit. And the only people who agree with them are the people in their circles who are making money on it. They're political strategists, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's funny. Yep. Like I said, it's funny to me that one of my tweets made it into the paper. I don't even know which one, but my mailman told me about it. And, you know, I was a little bit embarrassed, obviously, because I don't know which one. I mean, who knows? I throw shit posts out there.
Was it?
I don't even know. I throw shit posts out there all day. But he was happy. And he said, no, keep shitting on the politicians here. They're criminals. So I was like, you know what? If my mailman's, and even the neighbors, I've talked with my neighbors and said, like, you know what? Just in case someone brings it up to you, I kind of do this thing on Twitter and talk about politics here. And they're like, they're criminals. Get them out. I'm like, all right, good. They're all aligned.
God, thank you. Thank you.
We're all aligned. Oh, thank God.
something that needs to actually happening now is, I think, sometime in August, the just to further cement the you know, in the book, I talk about the civil war within the Popular Party.
Yep.
I mean, those people are really pushing out the pro-sovereignty people. You would think those are the people you want to come into the party to strengthen it. But no, the leadership of the Popular Party, the PPD, is so colonial, so still in 1952. Like, they still think that Muñoz Marín is still around and they're still living their high life of power. They still don't realize that they're nothing now. They're literally nothing. But this whole party has been living on that whole narrative for decades and decades, and saying that the U.S. is their bilateral partner, all this. And now the U.S. is saying, no, we lied. We were never a bilateral partner. Yep. We're just our territory. So now they're stuck in this situation where if they accept what's going on now, they're literally saying that, oops, sorry, people, we're idiots. they got us for 70, whatever.
Well, I think both PNP and PPD need to wake up and come to realization, which is they've been wrong. They've been wrong holistically about their entire premise. They've been wrong about how they're approaching it. They've been wrong. Bottom line, you have been wrong. And like I said, someone from the U.S. looks at them like, oh yeah, no, that's not going to happen. That's one of the reasons that they're so angry, is because they're like, no, but there was this, this, and this. And I'm like, you don't understand how the U.S. works. You don't understand it. Yeah.
They're still in denial. And I think what bothers also some of them, especially to admit, hey, because this really hurts them, of all things, is to admit that the independentistas were right.
Yep.
Because the independentistas were the ones that ever since 1950, they were saying that the Commonwealth is colonial. And they were people went to prison for saying that.
Yep.
I mean, like, people were persecuted, lost jobs, exiled for saying that. Now, and then even after all the persecution and being made fun of, oh, you're only 3%, da 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 da. Oh, now, 2022, the U.S. is agreeing with them. Yes, you are a colony. And now they're stuck in a situation where, I mean, how do you, you know, they were right.
Yep.
And they cannot come to terms with saying that they were wrong and the Independence Party was right.
Yep.
They can't come to terms with that.
This is a very familiar tale for me personally. But yeah, I did want to talk about one last thing before we, but I want to talk about this notion that's in the book about immigration.
Okay.
And we touched on it a little bit, but I just want to make it crystal clear because I've traveled, like you have traveled the world and seen different things. I've worked for companies that were based in France that, you know, all these different things, and it's still companies. It doesn't matter what the government is. There's still a company. You still do your job and you still whatever. Mm-hmm. Still conduct commerce because it has to happen. But the notion of when you lose population and you want to have a level of services that maintain or grow, hopefully, then you need new people. You need people to come back, right? Diaspora mm-hmm. to come back. And you need people to move here. Like you said earlier about the Germans, the French, the Italians, the Chinese, the people who've come here and said, I'll learn the language. I want to be part of this. I want to help bring my talents and or learn or whatever. Can you just touch on that quickly and what you say about that in the book? Because I'll just clear that up. I know that there's a lot of talk online about xenophobia and all those things. And like, but the reality of the situation is we need people in order to support those services and what have you.
Yep. No, thank you for bringing that up. So, the title of the book, and I purposely made it like that. I wanted to make it very strong, right? But it's Puerto Rico for Puerto Ricans. It's made not to exclude anyone. It's made to embrace that Puerto Ricans should have a nation of their own. Not in Russia, not in China, not in Antarctica, in Puerto Rico. Like, Puerto Rico should be the nation, the homeland of Puerto Ricans. That's it. Okay. Now, if Puerto Ricans live in France or other countries, good for them, whatever. But we should at least have a nation of our own. That's the whole point of that. Now, in terms of immigration and have people to Puerto Rico, I am of the opinion that if anyone in the world, black, white, whatever race, any country, you want to come to Puerto Rico and be part of the Puerto Rican nation and society and culture, please pack your bags and come to Puerto Rico and be part of this great, you know, society that we can create together. You know, there's no xenophobia here at all. Actually, the xenophobia usually from the stakeholders who want to have a, as they say, a Puerto Rico without Puerto Ricans. You know, they want to eradicate Puerto Ricans and put in here a bunch of people from Wyoming, and then hopefully they'll get statehood. I mean, that's the ridiculous concept. My belief, and that others have also, is that Puerto Rico should be the homeland of Puerto Ricans. But not only Puerto Ricans. If anyone of the world wants to come to Puerto Rico and contribute to our society, to help Puerto Rico build up, rise up, and hopefully when we become an independent nation, become a regional economic power, please help, come. If I could ever have a say in any future Puerto Rico immigration policy, I would make that as open and as inviting as possible. You know, I would encourage people who want to invest in Puerto Rico, want to live in Puerto Rico, but also to enrich Puerto Rico, not just to come here, you know, and just be racist and insult Puerto Ricans and get tax breaks like some are doing. Some,
yep.
But then there are other people, Americans and others, who are in Puerto Rico, who are embracing Puerto Rican culture, embracing the nation, just being part of society. That for me is the important part. You're embracing society. You're not living on the military base, only talking to 20 Americans and then referring to the Puerto Ricans as those people.
Yep.
You see? And there are people who do that. And that's what we don't want.
I know personally some very gross stories and that are of people, you know, they've been racist. I mean, quite frankly, and it's just like, unfortunately, I think the thing that like people come here for all different reasons, all different intentions. You get kids who are like trust fund kids from New York that want to surf. And so they come down, they spend 6 months in Rincon and they get the hell out of here. And whatever, that is what it is. I'm not going to, but people come here for all different reasons. But the reality of living here under the current conditions, under this government, is that it is hard. It's not easy all the time. You know, you can't get stuff that you could get elsewhere. It's not as accessible or easy. Some of it's by design, right? If you bleed stuff far enough and it collapses, I hope the U.S. bails us out or rescues us. But it's not easy. And so a lot of those people that come here who don't have, I've met some people who've been here for decades, are multi-generational, you know, people who moved here, whose parents and grandparents moved here. And they're good people. They brought expertise and they brought, like, they're part of society. They're fluent. Like, they're awesome people. But there's a lot of people, and you see them a lot in these different Facebook groups acting like, you know, like dumb tourists, essentially, you know, and exploiting and acting like just, you wouldn't act this way at home. Why would you act that way here, kind of stuff? But the reality is a lot of them leave because they just like, well, this isn't like, you know, Boston. Oh, this isn't like LA. Like, no shit. No shit.
Yeah.
If you moved here to make it like where you left, then go back to where you're from, because it's not how it is here. Mm-hmm. It truly is a different culture. Mm-hmm. And I've had such a good time talking with you about this. If you want to, by the way, follow Javier, he's on Twitter at PR Exit Book. And from there you can get to all of his stuff. You mentioned you have a website as well from the book that people can start to access all of your stuff as well. It was also prexitbook.com. Mm-hmm. So I encourage everyone, if you want to learn more about this and not the propaganda bullshit that you've been sold or that's been told in the local media or wherever, here on the island especially, or if you live in the U.S. and you're like, what's it really like there? Please dig in. You know, we need allies. You know, we need as many people who see the reality of the situation and where things are headed to help make this happen. And lastly, if you are Puerto Rican, please vote. I know that it may be a long line, it may be hot out, it may be whatever. We need people to vote to get these people out of office who have no intention of trying to make this island better and only selling it off or giving it away. So Javier, thank you for coming on again. It is Father's Day. So again, I'm
thank you.
Appreciative that you took time out of your day to do this. And
thank you. Thank you.
If you do like this podcast, please make sure that you go to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give us 5 stars. Javier, thanks again. Enjoy your day.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it.